Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. The program you are about to hear was originally presented at the National Press Club. Beyond the Book's Christopher Keneally hosts Hippies to Hackers, a look at how counterculture ideals have shaped technology and media since the 1960s, with guests John Markoff, John Leland, and Ken Goffman. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Good afternoon and welcome again to Beyond the Book. My name is Christopher Keneally, and as Director of Author Relations at the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center, it's my job and my pleasure to organize these occasional gatherings of authors and their audiences for what I like to think are explorations of issues facing the creative professions. Today we're going to look at the convergence of two seemingly disparate cultural communities, the world of computing and the realm of the counterculture. As our panelists will tell us, technology in 2005 has acquired a tremendous capacity for creativity and an almost dizzying power to affect change in every corner of our lives. Almost 40 years ago, though, this vision of technology's power was far less inviting. It's difficult to recall, but people once actually feared the computer. In 1968, Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke collaborated on 2001, A Space Odyssey, and they imagined HAL 9000, a supercomputer with a notoriously diabolical bug in its hardware. Futurists are always getting it wrong, and the Clarke-Kubrick nightmare never materialized, maybe because the supercomputer itself was replaced by a super network, the now ubiquitous and even solicitous World Wide Web, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this year, 2005. Today's theme song, if the program had a theme song, would probably be by the Grateful Dead, who I guess, after all, were the house band for the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1960s, at a time when the engineers and the visionaries came together in Palo Alto and throughout that area. Almost any Dead tune would do for a theme, but my preference would be for Trucking. Sometimes the light's all shining on me, other times I can barely see. Lately, it occurs to me what a long, strange trip it's been. So this afternoon, with the help of John Markoff, John Leland, and Ken Goffman, and with your help later in the program with your questions, let's explore that long road that led from the 1960s to 2005. And I want to start by welcoming John Markoff. John is the author of What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer. He is a senior writer for the New York Times and a three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee. He is co-author of Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier, and the best-selling Takedown, The Pursuit and Capture of Kevin Mitnick, America's Most Wanted Computer Outlaw. John comes to us today from San Francisco, where he lives and works, and welcome, John.
Thank you.
I guess we have to start really with an explanation of the book's title, which may mystify many in the audience. What did the Dormouse say exactly, and how does that have anything to do with the story you tell in your book?
Well, the title of my book comes from a song written by Grace Slick, who was a member of a band called Jefferson Airplane. I guess that's a long time ago, but probably most people here remember that. And the Dormouse, of course, said, feed your head. And of course, it's all tied up in Lewis Carroll. And I picked it, I guess, on one level because I couldn't find a good Grateful Dead lyric. But on another level, it sort of got at this connection I was trying to make between the experimentation that was going on during the 1960s with psychedelic drugs and this idea that Doug Engelbart was pursuing in computing that he referred to as augmentation. And so there was sort of a mind-expanding aspect to both activities, and I don't think it was coincidental that they both happened at the same time.
Well, it's interesting, I think, when you look back, today, from 2005 to 1965, is 40 years, which seems remarkable. And, you know, if we think about that distance, imagine that 1925 was as far away from them. And I think we've come a great way. And yet, because the music of the 60s is still with us and may always be with us, they feel much closer than that. And there was a time when things were different than we know them today. LSD was legal. The mainframe ruled. All of these things had a great impact, again, on the story you tell. You might want to expand on what you mean by augmentation and how that ran up against an opposite view of the world of computing as well.
Well, the term augmentation was one coined by this man by the name of Doug Engelbart, and I think Engelbart is this seminal figure in the development of the modern computer industry that we know, and although he's largely been forgotten. I mean, he's known by many people as the inventor of the mouse, but in fact, Engelbart really was in a small group of people during the 1960s at a research group called Stanford Research Institute, really invented most of the technologies that we think of as the modern personal computer and the internet. And he showed them to the world at this stunning demonstration. It's referred to as the mother of all demos in San Francisco in 1968. And it was really at that point that people in the computer industry discovered what interactive computing was. Before that, people had interacted with the computer in the glass house. And Engelbart really was one of the first people to have this vision of interactivity, and he really saw it as a tool to expand the human mind. He grabbed all kinds of ideas in this effort to build this system that would allow humans to cooperate and work together more effectively, to augment the human mind. He grabbed at all kinds of cultural things that were happening in the society while he was doing his research work. It was as much a sociology experiment as it was a technology experiment, including LSD, psychodramatic workshops, the Red Guards, the stuff that was going on with Mao in China in the 60s. He was willing to explore almost any of these ideas.
Right. I mean, the principles of the acid test, and perhaps you have to remind people of what the acid test was, got applied to the research that they were doing.
Well, you know, it's hard to think of there being principles in an acid test. The acid tests, LSD had been around the Bay Area for almost a decade before the acid test started in the mid-1960s. And the drug sort of leaked out into the popular culture, and the acid tests were that transition point. One of the first people to be engaged in the acid test, to help put them together, was this man, a former paratrooper and a former Stanford student, Stuart Brand, who's all wrapped up in the threads of the 60s counterculture. And the remarkable point of intersection about Brand is that he was brought in by Engelbart when he gave that demo I just talked about in 68 to act as a consultant, because he had been doing these multimedia extravaganzas around the acid tests, and they thought of him as a multimedia expert in the 1960s. So he actually ran the camera down in Menlo Park while they were doing the demonstration up in San Francisco.
Tell us more about that mother of all demos. What was it like?
Well, there were about 1,000, 1,500 people there, and essentially they had built this system which was an interactive computer system that was controlled by a computer, but it was controlled by a mouse, a screen that had many of the attributes of a modern personal computer screen. They had windows, they had hypertext, they had video conferencing. Doug also had this other kind of keyboard besides the standard typewriter keyboard. He had a cord key set so that you could actually type characters with your right hand while you controlled the mouse with your left, or vice versa. And he was connected by a microwave link to Menlo Park, and so he was showing people sort of this knowledge navigation idea at that point. And he really sort of blew the minds of the 1,000 best computer researchers in America at the same time. Computing was never the same after that had happened. And all kinds of people were there and influenced by that event. Alan Kay, who's sort of a seminal person in the personal computer industry, had got himself out of bed with 104 temperature to be there because he knew about some of Engelbart's ideas. Andy Van Dam, who was working with a man by the name of Ted Nelson on some of the same kind of hypertext ideas on the East Coast, was there and was just absolutely stunned that Engelbart had sort of pulled all this stuff together. They were still prototyping it on the East Coast. You can actually still see the demo. It's of course like everything else on the web, and the video is there to go watch. And it's still an incredible demonstration today. Nothing's lost, and the echoes from that created an entire industry eventually.
Right, and it began this journey for computing from number crunching to something that is actually now a media, a form of entertainment more than technological power. Talk about that a bit.
Well, so there was at that point, Doug had a slightly different vision. He saw the computer as like an automobile. I mean, he sort of was getting at this notion of that we think of now as cyberspace, but he thought of the computer as this sort of vehicle that you would sort of get into, if you would, and you would drive through this world of information. And Kay was the one. He had been a graduate student at the University of Utah, and he came to the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory for a year, and then he went with this idea of this thing he called the Dynabook, which was the prototype of the first personal computer, which was built during the early 70s at Xerox PARC. He came with that, and he came after sort of experiencing Engelbart's ideas, and he sort of modified it. He was the one who saw that the computing was going from being number crunching to being a media, to being a universal media. You know, we had media like books and television and radio. Computing as a media encompassed them all. And that was what intersected with this counterculture and made the people who were in the counterculture, I think, saw that first. That there was more than sort of blind number crunching, that there was a media that they could exploit and control.
The figure of Stuart Brand is a very appealing one to me. I find him interesting because the way I see it, he's neither an engineer nor is he a hippie, really. As you point out, he's much more of a straight character, at least at the beginning. The paratrooper background and so forth, and yet he has a remarkable influence. No one less than Steve Jobs said that the Whole Earth Catalog was the world's first search engine. How do you feel about Stuart?
Well, he's kind of like Forrest Gump. I mean, he's been at every juncture, critical juncture. He just has this knack of showing up at the edge at the right time. I don't know what it is about him. I think of him as the messenger. He was the first person to get it. He was the first person to see that this technology was going to have an impact on the culture. And the first time it happened was in the 1960s at Stanford. He had just gotten out of the Army. He was trying to become a photographer. He was wandering around the Stanford campus, and he wandered into one of these laboratories, and he saw these young men glued to a computer terminal. I mean, computer terminals didn't exist then. It was a round device playing this game called Space War. And he described it. This is like 62, 63. This was the first video game. And he realized that these young men were having what he called an out-of-body experience. What he had done is he'd stumbled across cyberspace. And he sort of filed that away. And a decade later, he came back and wrote this seminal piece called Life and Symbolic Death Among the Computer Bums for Rolling Stone, where, not in the article, but in a book that was based on the article shortly after, he coined the term personal computing. And so he was the sort of first one to get it, but he also brought this attitude with him in the Whole Earth Catalog, which was you can take these technologies that, if you will, were the man's technologies, were technologies that were not controlled by individuals, and you could turn them and you could use them for your own ends. The Whole Earth Catalog that he created was tremendously influential to the people who were building the technology. Alan Kay, for example, walked in one day at the Xerox PARC Research Center and put the Whole Earth Catalog down on the table and told the librarian to buy all the books that were in the Whole Earth Catalog. I mean, people really sort of found it to be a fascinating document and almost a Bible. And so he showed up at every juncture. I mean, he was there for the demo. He was at the computer labs. He brought Kesey in to see Doug Engelbart's. He brought Ken Kesey, the author, in, who was, of course, involved with the Merry Pranksters, in to see Engelbart's technology after he had gotten out of jail. And Kesey looked at it and he said, you know, it's the next thing after LSD. And in fact, it was the next thing after LSD. So I don't know what talent Stuart has, but it's really quite remarkable.
It is a remarkable one. And what's remarkable to me about the figures in your book is the power of the computer at that point was really scant relative to what we know it as today. And we could talk about Moore's Law in a minute and its impact. But I was struck over and over again by how imaginative and the breakthrough thinking that they engaged in. They could see something before they could build it.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I think that comes out of, that comes out of a grasping of the impact of this thing that we describe in Silicon Valley as Moore's Law. And that's simply it's not a law in the traditional sense. It's a statement of the economics of the industry, just the very nature of all of these technologies that computing is based on, storage and computing and communications, is they don't change in a linear fashion. They change exponentially. And so in the late 1950s, early 1960s, the people who were building the first integrated circuits realized that this technology was not going to be linear. And so, you know, of course, the consequence is that the computers that we use now in our PlayStations or in our digital watches literally have millions of times the processing power of the computers that they were using in the 50s. And they realized that was going to be true early on. And that sort of is what – I mean, that's, I guess, mind expansion in a non-psychedelic sense.
That really blows your mind to think about that it's going to continue at that rate.
I mean, the way I like to describe it is that the companies that make the world's fastest computers today are the companies that make things that go under Christmas trees. And you have to realize that technology no longer trickles down. It comes up from the largest markets are where the technology is developed first. And so if you see the Xbox Next or the PlayStation 3, those are $200, $300, $400 products that have supercomputer power.
And there's no reason to expect that to slow down anytime soon, right?
It's estimated
to continue for
the industry roadmap is pretty clear through 2015. And so, there's been a million-fold change in the last three, 4 decades. There'll be at least another million-fold change in the next decade. And, what's fun about that fact is that the visionaries are always wrong. Just consistently, it's because we live in this linear space, and it's very difficult to understand a nonlinear technology change. And so, for a reporter, it's great because the guys who are supposed to be the people who understand this don't understand it. Nobody does.
Well, some people get it more than others, and there are those figures in your book, and many of the names aren't household names, so they may deserve to be, and there are two at the end of the book who now are, and I'm thinking of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. How do you think the counterculture affected each of them and their vision of computing, and even as entrepreneurs?
Well, two tiny stories, perhaps, to sort of illustrate that. In April of this year, I interviewed Gates, and I interview him fairly often, so we know each other. And we both sort of grew up with the personal computer industry, and he was on this this trivia game with Mitch Kapoor at the Computer History Museum's Computer Bowl in April. And he just got devastated by Kapoor. Kapoor tore him apart. He was like fast twitch. He was answering these questions that Gates should have known. He was answering very quickly. And it was kind of embarrassing for Gates. And he walks across the hall afterwards for our interview, and I say, God, that was really tough. And he looks at me and says, yeah, it was like a bad acid trip. And in fact, Gates has publicly admitted, I think in Playboy at some point during the 80s, that he took acid a number of times. He was very much a part of that culture, the same culture that Jobs grew up in. Jobs grew up in Silicon Valley in the 70s. He went to Reed. He went to India after he dropped out of Reed. He experimented with psychedelic drugs. And when he was introducing, I interviewed him when he was introducing the iTunes software before it was had the commercial music store, but when it first came out where you could store your MP3s on the computer. And he was showing me the visualization feature, which puts all these swirly figures on the screen. And he turned to me and he had this sort of sly smile and he says, it reminds me of my youth. And that set me off because I was doing the research for this book and I began telling about people in the Valley who had experimented with psychedelic drugs during the 60s. And it just set him off in one of the most fascinating interactions I've had with him, because he said that taking LSD was one of the two or three most important things that he'd done in his life, that there were people who were close to him who had not taken LSD, who did not understand things about them because they hadn't shared that experience, and that he felt like an outcast in the industry in which he's a mogul, because most of the other moguls, Bill Gates aside, have not experimented with psychedelic drugs. So it's really, for Jobs, it's clearly one of the touchstones in his life, and that came out this year when he gave really quite a remarkable speech for Jobs. He spoke at the Stanford commencement about the value of dropping out, actually. And he talked about the Whole Earth Catalog. And it was a particularly interesting Jobs speech. Like everything else, you can see it on the web. It's worth taking a look at, because if you see Jobs on stage as the product pitched man, he's very comfortable in that element. And he talks from slides and everything. And here was Steve Jobs reading. And obviously this was a big deal for him because he's a college dropout. And it was an interesting interesting juncture. So,
well, thank you, John. It's a fascinating story and a wonderful book. Thank you for coming to Beyond the Book. I want to turn now to John Leland, who sort of sits in the middle here on this, I think, literally and figuratively. John is also a reporter for the New York Times, and he's the author of Hip, the History. He has written on pop culture now for two decades, and apart from his work today at the Times, he was previously an original columnist at Spin magazine and editor-in-chief of Details. He's come to us from New York City today. Welcome, John Leland.
Thanks.
Essential to your book, right from the very beginning, are some basic definitions of what it means to be hip and why hipness and hipsters and so forth are quintessentially American and have been with us for quite a long time, long before Charlie Parker and the Beats and so forth. For the audience, tell us what is hip, where did that word come from, and why does that origin matter?
Well, that was the hardest of the great searches in this book. It was kind of a mystery story. What is hip? Where did it come from? And how do we feel about it? And those are some of the questions I started out with. And, you know, I began to try to figure out where the word came from. And there was a lot of different theories about it. Some people felt it came from the opium dens, where people would lie on their hip and have a bruise on one hip, and it would be called laying the hip, would be smoking opium. And they would tell each other by that telltale bruise. And other people thought it came from prohibition. You would carry a hip flask, a little pint on your hip, and you would say, "Are you hip?" meaning, "Are you carrying?" And an English lexicographer named David Dalby traced it back to a West African word, hippie or heppy, meaning to see or to open your eyes. Meaning, so that... And I found that the most compelling of the origins, even though lexicographers can never quite agree on colloquial terms. You can never hammer them quite down. But that seemed like the most persuasive argument to me, that it comes from this idea of awareness or enlightenment. And so it doesn't begin as sort of that superficial trendy handbag, but a particular approach to information, knowing something that you're not supposed to know that the other person knows. And particularly it came over with West African slaves, so it takes root here in this unique interaction between these two populations, Europeans and Africans, on this new soil, inventing new identities for themselves as Americans in each other's presence.
And the interactions and the intermingling that go on throughout the generations is really what revives hip over time. There's a recycling, if you will, of its energy that way.
Again, we can follow that all in the word itself. How do we go from hippie or heppy, this Wolof word in West Africa, to our English word hip? It means that the white slave owners are going to have to, the adventurous ones are going to spy and try to figure out, what are these guys talking about? Does this have something to do with us? This is kind of interesting. Maybe we can use this on our own, and they will start using it among themselves. They'll be parodied by the slaves, who that's their way of controlling them. And the information goes back and forth and back and forth. And you know, if we look at our American cultural history, this is what's going to happen down the line with jazz and the blues and with hip-hop today. There's this kind of back and forth dance going on.
And hip is not counterculture. You made that point when we talked, and I wanted to ask you to tell us why and what is the essential difference. I think it really is pretty easy once you say it to grasp.
Well, I think what hip wants is autonomy more than rebellion or overthrowing the culture. So it doesn't have to run antithetical to anything. It wants to be free of that. And I think that we can see that in the people we know, that to be a rebel is to be defined by whatever you're rebelling against. So we often think of hipsters as rebels. I think they're more people who want their hands off.
The hipsters are hands off.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. And cool, where does cool fit in?
Well, you know, we use terms interchangeably, so I don't try to get too pedantic about this. But people who have followed the linguistic roots of Kuhl, mostly Robert Ferris Thompson at Yale, has also traced this to Africa, to an idea that has some kind of African ideas like wetness or salinity, but also a sense of calm in the individual and stability in the social order. And he traced it back to a king in Benin whose name was Ewuare, meaning it is cool, because he restored peace during an era of warfare.
Now you in the book explore how the story of Hip, the history of Hip, is an American history, really. And yet Hip has a global appeal. There are, though, some requirements for societies to sort of take on the notion of Hip and for it to become an active part of what they do. Talk about that.
Well, it can't work in a subsistence economy because Hip is itself something of a luxury. We have to be able to waste a gesture here or there in order to, you know, style is something that we have to be able to afford. So it doesn't exist in subsistence cultures. But, you know, that said, it does begin as this American idea because you had this unique meeting of people. But from there, it expands throughout the world. And you know, it's been an interesting thing to me to travel a little bit to the extent I have and see, you know, teenagers in Hong Kong who pose in a certain way. And that has everything to do with this American idea of Hip. Some of the footage we see from the banlieues in Paris, a little bit less so now, but, when I was there, I think 10, 12 years ago, was very much influenced by America.
And it is, though, apart from this need for a kind of economic liberty or room for maneuvering, it's an urban phenomenon.
Yeah, it only works where there's different kinds of people rubbing up against each other. Again, we had this meeting of two very different populations at the root of this. But there has to be that chance to share information with somebody else, to steal information from somebody else, and to try on being another identity other than your own. If you're in the small town where everybody knows who you are and they're going to tell your parents on you whenever they see you acting out, you know, it doesn't develop there. So the weird in the small town tend to move to the big towns where they're no longer the weird. They are part of a group of people who can exchange ideas, push each other to be a little more weird, and they can be seen and their ideas can circulate out from them.
The notion of taking on new identities, different identities, is something that I think gets us now to the subject of technology and where Hip and technology intersect. Because, again, if we think back to a point early in the development of the computer, technology, you know, IBM, it was as square as Mr. Cleaver, really. And today, not so at all. The dot-comers had a lot to do with that, but certainly what John Markoff talks about in his book had a great impact. How do you think the counterculture of the Bay Area helped to change what we think of as the character of technology?
Well, the first point I would make is that Hip has always piggybacked on technology, and particularly on media technology, because it involves, again, the spread of information. A small group of people need to be able to spread their codes to other people without someone else interfering in it. So, you know, in the book I write about how the cylinder press in the mid-19th century circulated Hip. The advent of radio helped circulate Hip in the 1910s and 1920s. Ditto the phonograph and the transistor radio in the 50s and 60s. So the internet or the personal computer worked in the same way. It allowed the information that would have been held by the corporations to sort of disseminate among the general populace.
Right. And as well, very early in the sort of acquisition or the movement of computing into, you know, a personal realm, people took on new identities that in cyberspace you became something you weren't in ordinary space, which seems to me to be part of that Hip notion of new identity or interchangeable identities.
There was that early expression, there's no such thing as a dog on the internet. We can all be whoever we want. We can trade identities. You're not tied to your birth in this medium that allows the invention of personalities, the invention of characters. So we're not limited to our circumstances of birth, so we can become whatever we want.
So, in fact, the geek, if you will, can become hip in that space, in that cyberspace.
Well, what did the earliest geeks have? They had access to this tremendous wealth of knowledge that nobody else could understand. It was vast. It was mysterious. It allowed them to be whatever they wanted to be. It was encouraging to alternate lifestyles, sexualities, etc. And it had its own kind of language and personal codes in the way that, say, the beat poetry scene and the bebop jazz scene did.
You talk in the book about the political philosophy of libertarianism and how that had a heavy influence on the development of IT in the 80s and 90s. What was it about libertarianism itself that was attractive? And I think we're sort of seeing a theme develop here. There was a freedom. I mean, libertarianism I think of as a kind of intersection of right and left philosophies, but it back 20 years ago had some important appeal to the people in the Bay Area.
Well, it had two things. It had tremendous autonomy, tremendous push for autonomy, and it was not averse to turning a profit, which some of the other hipster ideologies of the time would have been.
Now, the hipster is related to the trickster, which is a kind of a semi-mythical figure and someone familiar from African-American culture and any culture, really. Where do the hipster and the trickster and the hacker intersect, do you think?
Well, you know, if for people who don't know what a trickster is, if we think of Br'er Rabbit from the Joel Chandler Harris stories or Bugs Bunny in more recent times, those are trickster characters. And they're characters that a society invents to break its own rules because it needs them broken. Hackers certainly perform that function in the 1970s and 1980s because they were people who wanted to explore this frontier as far as you could go. See where, you know, what can you do in this new medium? How can you push yourself? What kind of information can an individual get? What can they do with that information? And so, I mean, a lot of the hackers worked in groups which differentiated them from traditional tricksters. But they were, I think, the people our society invented to break the rules that we needed to be broken to move forward technologically.
Do you think at this point that we live in still a hip world? Is it a post-hip world? And if it's post-hip, what's next?
Well, I call it post-hip because anything that was hip 3 seconds ago is now passé, and it's sold to you in a TV commercial. So it seems like it's almost impossible. But I still think that what's really hip is what was always hip. It's that special kind of knowledge or awareness that takes you outside of your own circumstances of birth, your own personal identity. And now it's no longer black, white, rich, poor. You need to fill a lot of different niches. But that's still possible.
And the internet, the web, seems to really enable that, doesn't it?
Well, I think the web did away with this idea that there's a mainstream and an alternative culture. Because in the web, everything is flat. And everything is an alternative culture. So the RNC and avant-garde quilting societies and strange fetishes all exist on roughly the same, on parallel terms.
And the intermingling is happening in cyberspace rather than in an urban space. I mean, it can continue to happen in the urban spaces and will, but that person in Idaho searching for community does not need to move to the Bay Area as urgently as they might have before.
Well, I'm kind of two minds on this idea of intermingling, because on the one hand, it can happen, as you say, we're not limited by geography. But you can also spend all your time in your alternative quilting society and never meet mainstream quilters.
So it's confining.
So there's that sense that you can limit yourself to your niche. And I think those two ideas are working in constant opposition. People want to come down on one side or the other. I don't think either of those is quite fair, but it's possible to do either.
Well, thank you, John Leland. Fascinating book, Hip the History. I want to turn now to Ken Goffman, who is also known as Are You Serious? Ken is the author of Counterculture Through the Ages and is a well-known cultural commentator and was co-founder of Mondo 2000. which you may know was the iconoclastic magazine that defined the digital culture of the early 90s. Ken is author or editor of 7 books, including Mondo 2000, A User's Guide to the New Edge, and The Revolution, and he co-wrote Timothy Leary's last book, Design for Dying. And Ken lives in Mill Valley. Welcome to Beyond the Book, Ken.
Thank you.
Perhaps the way to start this, and I think to tie it in with authors and their work, is to think about the impact of technology on creativity and just on the business of writing itself. And to go back to the figure that John discussed, Stuart Brand, and that famous quote, information wants to be free. It also wants to be expensive, but that's the part of the quote that's forgotten. What is thoroughly countercultural about that statement, do you think?
Well, I think what Stuart was really talking about is that information wants to travel freely. It wants to move across borders and across boundaries. Peculiarly, I think of Ronald Reagan, someone who was not a friend of the counterculture of the 1960s when he stood at the Berlin Wall and said that basically that there's no way that this wall can contain information and culture and culture and communications in this era. So that's one aspect of information wanting to be free. Of course, counterculture, as we posit it in our book, is all about rooting around bureaucracy and orthodoxies and challenging those things or moving beyond them. And the sharing of information, the liberating of information from elite groups and spreading it around to larger groups of people, ever larger groups of people, or just getting a hold of it for oneself or one's group, has been this process, this countercultural process across Western history, across all human history, actually.
Right. The notion of making things available, I think you say, is one of the principles of the counterculture. And you identify, if not the first great counterculturalist, but one of them was Prometheus. Talk about that.
Well, of course, Prometheus was a myth. It was a Greek myth, and one of the myths of Western civilization. And Prometheus, of course, stole fire from the gods, and was very specific in the myth as written by Aeschylus. That this was about technology, it was about science, it was about medicine, it was about education. For the Greeks, this was Prometheus was a bad boy. This was a shocker that this person wanted to allow people to have access to science and technology and so forth. And I think across history, as we show in the book, this has been a tendency for groups to come along and to invent technologies and techniques and ways for people to be creative for themselves and to invent and to spread them around.
Right. I mean, technology today means something with a chip in it, but it really, at its very earliest stages, were just, you know, tools, and the gradual evolution of our tools, more complicated tools.
Well, nothing. I mean, like the publication of the first encyclopedia during Enlightenment, which took all kinds of information from small specified guilds and allowed it to be shared by everyone. I mean, that's, you know, the great moment in open source culture.
Right. Well, I'm just going to go to the Whole Earth Catalog. I mean, Stuart Brand keeps coming up here, but that was an attempt to do very much the same thing, right? A kind of encyclopedia of tools that you could use to, you know, invent the future.
Again, I think that this idea that you could do it yourself, that whatever tools are out there, whatever information is out there, can be taken up by individuals and small groups without having to go through a bureaucracy or an orthodoxy or whatever. Has been with us for a long time, and the Whole Earth Catalog was one of the first great expressions of that. What was it? Tools for I can't remember the exact
tools
quote.
For living. Was it?
Tools for living, something along those lines. Yeah.
Right, and the DIY notion was something that was adopted by people who didn't resemble the hippies at all. It was something that the punks took on, and something that you explored in Mondo.
Right. Ironically, the Whole Earth Catalog was very much used by Back to the Earth, anti-urban kind of hippies who had dropped away from that culture. But the idea of do-it-yourself was picked up by the punks, by punk rock, and the idea that you could get a mimeograph machine and you could create a zine, you could put your music on a cassette and you could share it around, you can put on your show, you can steal a guitar and an amplifier and learn a few chords and have a rock and roll band, you can create your own fashions. And eventually, punk started to actually create institutions or something like institutions and collectives and squats and peculiar moment in rock culture that seemed to be so nihilistic and seemed to be, saying there is only, this moment and there's no future, turned out to be this thriving thing where there are punks in Mexico and there were punks in Sarajevo during the troubles there, and it was like really strong groups of people who helped other people like themselves to live autonomously and in a celebratory fashion under the worst of circumstances. It's one of the great countercultures, I think.
How has the web and the availability of information changed the work you do as a writer?
Well, it's devalued me pretty much. Talk is cheap, as they say, and talk has never been more cheap than it is now. Talk is all there is. In a mediated culture, also in terms of what John Leland was talking about in terms of identity, that's the lingua franca of our time. That's pretty much all we've got. Everybody is trading in identity. So it's made it complex and the specialization of the writer, I think, is something probably that's dying. There's still maybe, your Dostoevsky type who writes an extraordinary 800-page novel that, 30 or 40,000 literati just love, and that's still valuable and important, but it's a cottage industry. Mostly it's become very democratic, which is good.
Sure.
On the whole.
Right. But it also, as an activity, the research has changed, you said, that it's gone from something pre-web where you gathered information to the point where you have to kind of push it away.
Yeah, I think that's true of research, and I also think it's true in general of just like people who are looking for cool stuff, and it's true for people who are trying to develop media and get it to people and for consumers of media that rather than when I was a 20-year-old hipster in the 1970s, I spent, going from my town to New York City, I'd spend 3 hours getting to New York City so I could go to the East Village and buy Punk Magazine and a few other things and a few buttons and a few CDs that I couldn't get in the small town. And this was a big thrill, and I was very excited to have it. And now, kids sitting there at the computer have just zillions of signals coming at them, and lots of it is pretty cool, and it's kind of like it's all about how do I push the stuff away and find just those few nuggets that I really want. And there's a sad aspect to that because we lose some of the potential for serendipity. A lot of younger people now are very impatient. If, something doesn't grab them within a few seconds, push it aside, and because they know what they want, and there are going to be enough iterations and variations off of the core kernel of what they want that they're going to be able to move from there and find a whole bunch of other stuff that they want, and so some elements of surprise are removed. One of the things about counterculture is that particularly the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, that there was a spirit of spontaneity there. And in the web, you lose some of that in some ways because you're not in this physical environment where surprise can happen. But you also, people want spontaneity on the web, which is why they insist on engaging, for instance, in file sharing and so forth. I mean, the great pain of people trying to intervene and stopping people from sharing stuff, file sharing on the web, isn't so much that the people who are trying to stop them are being greedy. It's that they're interrupting the natural spontaneity of people getting together and sharing stuff.
Well, John Leland talked about a flatness to the web, and it echoes something you had said about how people have become pancake people, was the term you used.
Well, actually, that comes from a playwright, Richard Foreman, from New York City, who wrote an essay that said that people have become pancake people. They become flat and wide, they don't have the classic sort of European intellectual depth where they build up this, sort of classic personality and deep sort of intellectual basis and so forth. But their tentacles are out all over the world, and they're able to pick up bits and pieces of information really fast and synthesize them together.
Well, it's a great start to what I hope will be a continuing conversation. These are ideas that are going to matter to us for many years to come. And I want to turn now to the audience and sort of ask you whether any of the points made by the authors today have challenged you, or you want to ask specific questions. We have a handheld microphone, which will go around. And if you raise your hand, we'll get the microphone to you.
Hi. I was wondering about, this is for anybody really, but hierarchies of culture, like the 100 great books that you have to read, or a symphony orchestra, a museum that has to be supported with your tax dollars and that kind of stuff, as sort of the last remnants of kind of anti-market thinking, that these are come from the top down, and they're what you need, and they're not what you just pick out for yourselves. They're what somebody has decided is what you really need. How much of that is left, and is there any future for that kind of thinking?
Ken?
I think it's sort of like talking about the Dostoevsky and novel. I think there probably will always be a cottage industry for people who want to go see, big, serious art in the classical session. Whether they can get state funding or not, I guess, is part of the question maybe that you're asking, and whether that sort of thing can survive without state funding might be the other question. But I tend to think that if something has an audience, even if it's a small audience, that particular thing will find a way to survive all the changes. So I think these new cultural forms don't completely erase the previous cultural forms. I think there are always people who remain interested and hang on to, just like the hip quilting clubs or whatever.
This one is great, and this one is just popular, and that one is...
Well, I think that's already dead in the sense that nobody's really paying attention to it except, a few professors, Bloom or whatever. I mean, in some ways it's been blown apart by the post-structuralists and the post-modernists and all that.
What about the notion, though, that counterculture and indeed hipsters need something to either want to be free of or want to oppose, and that tension is a creative tension and one that propels change? If it's gone, if there is no establishment, computing power may continue to grow exponentially, but is the vision to put that power to use hobbled somehow?
Well, it would be hard to be a transgressive zine rock band filmmaker today because there isn't that kind of establishment, as you say, to push against. I think that we still, in answer to that previous question, I think we still like that curatorial function. We still want someone to tell us what the 10 best, you know, cupcakes are, or this or that. But we want to have the freedom to choose our own curators. We don't want them coming out of a kind of high arts national establishment.
And that's what bloggers are, basically. Hmm. A lot of them are.
I think it's early to sort of celebrate the death of hierarchy, too. You know, one of the things about the changing technology, these centralization versus distribution and democratization tend to go back and forth. And I think you can see as many trends towards centralization and central authority in the network as you can see this sort of centrifugal force. So, you know, I think that hierarchy is still there. And in fact, some of these institutions you described may actually end up having more influence.
Example of
a centralized in this world the power of brand. Brands don't go away, but there used to be this argument about the internet is that, you know, it had a shelf that was unlimited, so you went beyond the five brands. But I don't see that. We're still stuck on a very small number of brands, and maybe in fact the number of brands won't change at all in terms of the distribution of actual. I mean, look at Google.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think if there's a new central authority, it's possibly Google. I mean,
here we have this place where you can go to any search engine in the world. And in fact, we all seem to be going to the same search engine. What's that about?
Well, also, I mean, the role of Google is to send you to any of, you know, like a zillion different possible places. Also, I mean, in terms of the possibility of having something to rebel against, you know, I would say, you know, thank God for Ralph Reed and Bill Bennett and, you know, the so-called red states and all of that. I mean, there's still some push and pull. There's still people out there who get shocked, you know, which, you know, makes life fun sometimes.
And Google is an interesting thing to chat about, I think, in the context of this conversation, because its motto, "Don't do evil," seems to be a countercultural, a sort of countercultural statement. John, you're nodding your head. Yes, but are they a countercultural company?
Well, I think that no, you can't. I mean, not counterculture in the sense that, I mean. You know, this is a company that was funded by blue chip venture capitalists. It is, if you go there, it feels like the set of a Hollywood movie. You know, I don't think that there is a very free culture. You know, they mandate that you have 20% of your time to do whatever you want. So, maybe it's a libertarian culture, but I don't know what they're countering except perhaps Microsoft. And so maybe in that sense it's a counterculture. Maybe it's the Valley Strikes Back. Maybe it's you can look at it in terms of Star Wars metaphors and it makes some sense. Actually, maybe that works. I don't know. They certainly live within that cultural framework.
Right. And John Leland, you talked with me about work and play and how for the dot-comers, work became play and that had a hipness to it, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the great traps that people fell into, that you could spend 80 hours a week working at your job. And it wasn't really like a job because, boy, you had this funky office set up and your boss had a skateboard over in the corner and there were stock options and you could bring your dog to work and, you know, you could thrash on your computer at work better than you could at home. But it was really still work.
Right. Please.
I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason Magazine. I find the panel really fascinating. And my question is, what's the next drug? Because, I mean, each of you in different ways were talking about it. I mean, there's an intersection here of drugs and technology. We know what the technology, at least through 2015, you know, is going to be the web or the internet as it's currently kind of composed. So what's the next drug? And also, if I could just, as a manager myself, I just want to say Google is brilliant if they say 20% to do whatever you want, because in my experience, that would mean that, you know, I think most of my employees are goofing off for 40% of their time.
I don't know why everybody looked at me. I'm not holding. The next hour, of course, I mean, the development of drugs with biotechnology is, you know, move so quickly, and there have been everybody used to laugh at us at Mazda 2000 talking about smart drugs, and now there have been articles, you know, on the cover of Newsweek and Businessweek and Forbes and all these publications about a whole new generation of drugs that might increase intelligence, let people performance enhancement, basically. I mean, it's the same thing that people are talking about and arguing about in sports and so forth. So I think that's a large part of it. And actually, when you talk to people who are really involved in cognitive areas, neurophysiology and neurodrugs and so forth, they're also already starting to talk about empathy drugs and drugs that affect emotions and so forth. So I think that's probably one of the frontiers. And on the other hand, there are people going off to try ayahuasca out in the Amazonian rainforest or whatever, and that's a huge thing. Sometimes they're the same people. So.
Please take the microphone. Thanks.
I was wondering if someone could give me a good definition of postmodern. I've been trying to understand that.
John Leland, you want to try? I'll put you on the spot.
I've never heard a good definition of postmodern myself, so I'm going to wing it here as much as anyone else does. I think it's culture that exists in reference to itself, that talks through symbols about itself, that discusses itself as culture in the course of telling its stories.
Yeah, modernism believed that there was some kind of bottom line, basically, in discourse, that there was something that you could refer to that was, you know, solid and meaningful, that Western civilization was built on. And postmodernism just sort of says all of that is sort of dissipated.
Modernism was fundamentally idealistic, and it seems to me that postmodernism, even John, the way you describe it, is fundamentally ironic, and there's a big difference there.
Well, there's actually an irony here, because we're talking about science and technology, and modernism very much believed in science, and postmodernism does not believe in science or is not religious about science. And I think it may be important to point out, that a lot of people who identify with counterculture really don't identify with the technoculture at all. In fact, you know, they'll be the strongest voices in our culture in opposition to the culture of technology. And, you know, science in some ways has become the new establishment, the new religion, and people voice their dissent to that. And any kind of dissent, I think, is always, you know, legitimate and welcome.
You have a question?
Yes. I don't know if any of you have ever read The Machine Stops, the H.G. Wells story, but he depicts a universe in which, or a culture in which people are isolated in little individual pods and they only communicate remotely. And I wonder if you could talk about the danger of our doing that, and which is that we have access to pretty much anything in the world, but we don't have to leave the house to do it, which definitely warps your opinion and views of how things work.
John.
There was some wonderful survey research at Stanford within the last 5 years about the decline in face-to-face time, which sort of challenged the optimistic internet view that the internet was creating community. And he hypothesized that, in fact, the internet was isolating us at a really rapid rate. And, of course, that was greeted with great howls of anger by the pro-internet community. But I found it to be very telling. And in fact, I think the danger in making assessments about these things is if you believe my assertion about the rate of technical change, then any kind of assumption about the state of technology at any moment, you know, it's going to be different tomorrow. And the sociological fact of people sitting in their homes in front of terminals and clicking in a Pavlovian fashion, I think we're going to be beyond it very quickly. So it may be just one of these interim states that is not the future, it's now.
Well, of course, they have this thing now called Meetup, which is like, wow, what a novel thing. We can we can connect through the internet, and therefore we can actually get together in real space. I always think that there's this notion when people talk about how people are being isolated behind their computers, there's this notion that before that people had really kick-ass social lives, you know, like people in the 1950s were just, you know, they're out there just hugging each other and really getting together, you know. To some extent, in the late 60s, there was some of that, but
they were home watching TV in the 50s.
So I mean, part of the thing is compared to what,
right? And John Leland, disconnection is critical to this description you gave of the post-hip world, isn't it?
It is, but you know, we could think of a telephone conversation as being a remote conversation, but we know that the telephone conversation is in many times a very intimate part of our lives, and so it's not the technology that isolates us. I think it's if we're isolated, it's a drive towards isolation.
Any other questions on the floor? Yes.
Yes, hello. My name is Joshua Burlow, and I've got a blog at burlow.blogspot.com. I encourage everybody to go read it once they get home behind their computer. But one of the things that I've given some thought to, and this ties in with what the earlier person was saying about hierarchy, is to the extent that hierarchy exists in a major way in our culture, it exists in academia. Now, I know that nobody in the panel is apparently a current academic, but I believe that the internet is, to some degree, a threat to academic hierarchy. And I think this also ties in with the Enlightenment. And I know there's a chapter in Are You Serious's book about the Enlightenment. And I was wondering if anybody had any comments on what is the future of higher education vis-a-vis the internet, or if there is any, and also, of course, the counterculture in the 60s had something to do with countering the academia of that time. So there is a tie-in at least a little bit here. So that's my question.
John Leland, has the academia or has the academic community ever been hip?
No.
I mean, I suppose there are members of the academia academia that have been hip themselves.
Now, like, academic life is often our first time away from home. It's the first time to get away from your small communities and your first taste of a broader world at large, where you are in a place where you are there to receive ideas and share ideas and develop ideas. So it has this capacity for this. If we think about this in history, we can think about Burroughs and Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg coming together at Columbia College in 42-44. So, and they were drawn there for a number of different reasons. But that's available to you. Does the academic world guarantee that, or does it seem to still cultivate that? Maybe not quite in the same way.
Ken or John? Sorry.
Well, what was the question again?
how is the internet challenging the authority of academia?
I think that might be somewhat exaggerated. I mean, you have this image of people running around with their text message machines and, you know, their access to the net and so much information and so much creativity at their fingertips that they really don't need the old professor, the boring old professor. But, I mean, there's also a tremendous problem with literacy and, ignorance and lack of education. So I don't think we can really count on people just sort of, you know, picking up their toys and finding their way to toward being well educated. And I do think, I mean, some professors are sort of hip. There is a kind of a hipness factor to the whole postmodern thing, whether you appreciate where they're coming from or not. There is this kind of the black leather professor who, you know, teaches his students Kathy Acker and William Burroughs and Baudrillard, and, you know, there is that kind of hipness thing going on in academia.
There's also a skepticism that's essential to academic research. It asks questions, it doubts, it doesn't take anything at face value. Has what's happened in the internet, where the information is now just so abundant, people are almost stupefied and don't ask enough questions? I mean, Google turns up a million answers, and one of them might be right, and the rest of them might be completely useless to you.
But what I don't see is what was implicit in what you're saying. You know, the standard vision of the internet was that the lectures of the great professor were going to be accessible to all. And in fact, they are, but I don't see that as being an educational process or an educational thread and an alternative educational approach yet, which is surprising to me, because those things now are widely available, and apparently it's economically affecting universities, but I don't see it coalescing in any kind of new kind of internet-based educational community yet.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, I have very much enjoyed the conversation with all three of you, Ken Goffman, John Leland, John Markoff. Appreciate your joining us for Beyond the Book. Thank you all, and thank you for coming.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier resource for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond. To learn more, please visit www.beyondthebook.com.